We are here tonight to welcome Ian Morris, and I couldn't be more delighted. This is a meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, and as I said, I'm representing George Hammond for the Humanities Forum, which puts on more than 30 programs a year, some of them in association with Humanities West. The next two will be Monday, April 8th, Natalie Cleaver on the Oration on the Dignity of Man at 6 p.m. That's part of the Monday Night Philosophy series, and also on April the 8th at noon, Marty Brownstein, Two Among the Righteous Few, A Story of Courage in the Holocaust. So please join George at these events. As I said, it's my great pleasure to introduce to you, if you don't already know Ian Morris, who's a favorite speaker of mine. Ian is Jean and Rebecca Willard Professor of Classics and Professor of History at Stanford. He grew up in Britain and studied at Birmingham and Cambridge universities before moving to the University of Chicago in 1987 and on to Stanford University in 1995. Between 2000 and 2007, he directed Stanford's archaeological excavations at Monte Pulizzo in Sicily, and he served at Stanford as Senior Associate Dean of Humanities and Sciences, Chair of the Classics Department, Director of the Stanford Archaeology Center and Social Science History Institute. That's just the administrative stuff. In 2012, he was elected as a Corresponding Fellow of the British Academy. He has published 12 books and more than 100 essays in scholarly journals and newspapers. His book, Why the Rest Rules for Now, The Patterns of History and What They Reveal About the Future, published in 2010, won many literary awards, was named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times, The Economist, Foreign Affairs, Newsweek, Nature, and the London Evening Standard, and it's been translated into 12 languages. Foreign Policy magazine ranked it number 2 among the books global thinkers were reading in 2011. His most recent book, The Measure of Civilization, which Ian will be signing when this program is over, there are some copies, was published by Princeton in January of this year. He's spending the academic year 2013-14 as a National Fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, and during this year, two new books will be coming out. War, What Is It Good For?, from Farrar, Straus, and Gouraud, and Forages, Farmers and Fossil Fuels, The Evolution of Human Values, from Princeton. You are a busy man. Ian wowed the Humanities West audience at our Piracy program in September of 2012 and at our Minoan Crete program in April of 2011, and I know that he'll wow us now. Now, we are going to have a Q&A period after Ian speaks to us, and I think we'll just use the microphone instead of having you have to write the questions down. So please join me in welcoming to the podium Ian Morris.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Paddy, for that very kind introduction. And I'd like to thank George for inviting me here, even if he then felt it was worth going all the way to Germany to avoid actually having to be here. But I'd also like to thank all of you for coming here on this beautiful evening when there are so many other things you could be doing rather than listening to me. So what I'm going to talk about this evening is, I think, a common sense kind of idea, basically a sort of truism, that the past is not a very good guide to the future, but it's the best guide we've got. And that's the basic idea I want to sort of go on about for half an hour, 40 minutes or so. I'm here to talk about the book that Paddy just mentioned, The Measure of Civilization, which I, cannot get the computer to work. Oh, it didn't take me long. Ah, okay, I guess I was pressing the wrong button, that was why. Okay, which came out in January from Princeton University Press. In fact, came out on my birthday. So I'm going to talk about this book, which I wrote to delve into this basic idea that the past is the best guide we've got to the future. And the claim I make in this book is that we can identify long-term patterns of history, get a sense of what has driven history, and also get a sense of where that might be taking us in the 21st century. So this is the basic idea. And I got interested in this problem of, you know, whether we can identify big patterns in the past, whether we can project them forward. I got interested in it probably seven years ago, from a debate that had grown up among historians, global historians, interested in the patterns of the whole world. What had become really, I think, the biggest debate among these people in the last 30 years or so. And this debate said that, you know, if you look at the history of the world, a weird thing has happened in the last few hundred years. A small group of nations around the shores of the North Atlantic Ocean has basically taken over the world. You see them? No, you don't see them. Here you see them. In the process of doing that a few hundred years ago. And this big debate got going in Europe. Europeans started saying, well, we have a problem. I mean, it's a pretty good problem as problems go. Our problem is that we seem to have taken over the world and nobody's quite sure why this happened. So they get into these furious debates about why this happened, and lots of ideas come up. But the one that in the end kind of won out in the intellectual debates in Europe was that, well, it said, Europeans are special people. Something weird has happened in Europe, they said. If you go back 2,500 years, back to the time of the ancient Greeks, they say, the ancient Greeks invent this unique civilization, which is different from and basically better than civilizations anywhere else in the world. It's more rational, more democratic, more creative, all kinds of good things, they said. This civilization then gets picked up by the Roman Empire, spread all the way across Europe by the Romans, passed down through the ages, until finally you get to the pinnacle of Western civilization. There you have it. So this was the basic argument. And as you are clearly, it's a popular argument. People love it. This argument is very, very strong, very successful. I'm sure many of you heard variants of this argument when you're in school or in college. Problem, though. Across the course of the 20th century, it came under more and more criticism, especially from anthropologists and other social scientists who said, it just doesn't really make sense of the world. And then the criticisms really took off in the last quarter of the 20th century, driven very much by the East Asian economic boom. And people were saying, well, you know, if ancient Greece invented a civilization that made Europeans superior to everybody else, made European colonists in North America and other places superior to everyone else, why is all this happening? Why is first Japan, then China, why do they seem to be taking over the world? So a great argument blew up among the historians, trying to understand the big shape of world history. And these debates, they make for pretty interesting reading. If, like me, you're paid to sit around reading these books, it's a pretty interesting read. But the more I got into reading these debates, the more I felt that there was this kind of basic confusion surrounding the arguments that were going on. The confusion came, I felt, from people just not really having agreed on what it was exactly that we were trying to explain here. And so you get different specialists looking at different kinds of evidence on different timescales, coming to different conclusions, not even agreeing on what constituted, you know, proof in the evidence. What would you need to find to prove your point, whatever your point might be? So all this confusion developed, lots and lots of arguments. And as I got interested in this problem, I started to feel that perhaps what we need here is just something to make everybody be on the same page and agree what it is that we're arguing about. And I felt that the best way to do that would be through some kind of numerical index that would force people to get into an argument over the same things, at least. That I felt, would show us what the pattern is that needs to be explained. And then we could concentrate on yelling abuse at each other, which is what historians do anyway. But we'd be yelling abuse productively, and that is surely the point of the argument. So the more I thought about the debates that have been going on, the more I came to the conclusion that these arguments were about what in my most recent couple of books I've been calling social development. The argument was really all about social development. And what I mean when I say social development, one of my pet peeves is people who read out PowerPoint slides, because obviously you can read. But I'm going to do it anyway because I have the slide and I can do it. But just so we know, you know, right at the beginning what it is I think I'm talking about. And this thing, social development, that it seems to me the argument's all about. What I basically mean by this is like a bundle of technological, subsistence, organizational and cultural accomplishments through which people feed, clothe, house and reproduce themselves, explain the world around them, resolve disputes within their communities, extend their power at the expense of other communities' power, oops, the word dropped out, and defend themselves against others' attempts to extend their power. Now, it means like a group's ability to master their physical and intellectual environments, to get things done in the world. This, it seems to me, is what the argument is all about. It's about who had most social development, when and where. And that's the pattern that needs to be explained. Now, the older theories, although, I mean, people don't usually define the terms in exactly this sort of way, but the older theories, it seems to me, are saying that Western social development has been ahead of other parts of the world for thousands of years, since the time of the ancient Greeks. And the implication in a lot of the older theories is that this is just the way it's going to be from here on out. The pattern is now set, and the West came to dominate the world, and that's really the end of the story. The newer theories say a lot of different things, a lot of different versions of this. But basically they say, no, it's not. So that's just not the way it is. The newer theories tend to say either other parts of the world have had higher social development in the past, or maybe all parts of the world had similar development. But the implication with the newer theories tends to be that this pattern is not set in stone, that the Western domination of the world is a relatively short-term thing. It's going to go away. Now, as I see it, these are basically quantitative claims about how much social development did different parts of the world have at what times. But the arguments have all been qualitative, and that's made it difficult for people to kind of get on the same page and make their arguments be constructive. So what I decided we needed to do was figure out some way to measure social development across long periods of time in different parts of the world and then compare them, and see which of these theories, the older or the newer one, explains the reality better. So that was the idea. Now, the original plan, the way I was going to do this, was I was going to do all my comparing, draw up all my tables, and then write a book, which I did. I wrote the book, and the book came out a couple of years ago called Why the West Rules for Now. And this book would basically be providing the sort of narrative explanation of the shape of world history. And all the details about the index, how I calculated these numbers, what they were, what all the data looked like, that I would just put up in a gigantic website. Because I thought, you know, we're all very digital people now. Who wants to have a book full of all this information when you can all go online and consult the data there? Well, what I discovered, of course, was that nobody went online to consult the data. We may be very digital people, but we don't actually do things like that. And so I was very sorry for myself for a while. This book had come out, as if the world is against me. But one day, I was having lunch with my editor at Princeton University Press, Rob Tempio, and he, you know, these publishers' lunches always go the same way. They buy a very nice lunch, you get lots to drink, so it's all great. But at a certain point, they always say, "So, how's the book coming along?" And the answer, it's always some variant on the same answer, because it's not, usually it's not coming along. And so I'm saying, well, there's this and there's that. But what's delayed the next book is that last summer, this was in 2011, we're having this conversation. Last summer, I basically wrote this entire book and put it up on a website. And Rob just about, you know, choked on his lunch. He said, you wrote a book and you haven't done anything with it. You have to publish this. And so I said, well, you know, it's all this stuff explaining these large patterns and all this data. And he said, people are going to want to read this. I was very, very skeptical about this. But it turned out, as always with Rob, this is the book that's now come out. As always with Rob, he was completely right about this. I've been very surprised, very pleasantly surprised by the interest that there's been in this book. I was talking to the World Bank about it. Last week I was interviewed by Fareed Zakaria to go on his TV show. All kinds of people are very interested in this. So, and I assume you are too. I mean, you showed up. So my plan this evening, what I'm going to do, I'm going to talk about this book for the remainder of my time. I'm going to try to explain this index of social development that I came up with. And then talk a little bit at the end about what it might tell us about where the world is going next. So that's the basic plan. Okay, this social development index then, what I did. took a lot of inspiration in all this work I've been doing from a famous part-time historian, I'm sure many of you will recognize, when not busy saving the world. Winston Churchill, as many of you will know, wrote lots of history books, and he had this thing he liked to say, which is that the farther backward you can look, the farther forward you are likely to see. And I think he was exactly right about this. To understand social development, this large pattern, you've got to look back a very, very long way in history to see the full pattern. And I think that's why it's not always been obvious to historians. They're not looking back far enough. And in fact, I think you need to look back to the first point in history when we start to see vastly different ways of life appearing in different parts of the world. And that's a really long time ago. That's actually the end of the last ice age, about 15,000 years ago. This is a very, very long time ago. What happens at the end of the last ice age? Well, as sort of seems pretty logical, the end of the ice age, so the world is warming up. World warms up, global warming kicks in. Then, as now, global warming affects the whole planet, but affects different parts of the planet in different ways. And particularly, there's a band of latitudes running across the planet. You see it on this map here, what I've taken to call the lucky latitudes, although some people think that is not a very good name for it, but they're wrong. Running in the old world from China to the Mediterranean, and the new world between roughly Mexico and Peru. In this part of the world, as the world warms up, there are more species of plants and animals have evolved in these places that people can domesticate than anywhere else in the world. So population grows at the end of the Ice Age. Hunter-gatherers increasingly become farmers, domesticating plants and animals. But these areas here, the lucky latitudes, have massive concentrations of the kinds of plants and animals that can be domesticated. The result of that is that these are the first places in the world where people become farmers, domesticate plants and animals, huge increase in food supply, massive increase in population of humans, and also a massive increase in the complexity of their societies as these groups get bigger and bigger and bigger. Within the lucky latitudes, different areas have different concentrations of plants and animals that can be domesticated. The area marked on here is the hilly flanks. I'm going to abandon my microphone. This is the area in the world that has the densest concentrations of domesticable plants and animals. Not surprisingly, this is the area in the world where farming first begins, by about 9,000 BC. The eastern end of the lucky latitudes in the old world, in what's now China, that has the next densest concentrations. By 7,000 BC, agriculture has begun there as well. Now, in what I hope is a sort of obvious common sense move, I call the societies that have descended from this westernmost core of agriculture, Western societies, the ones that have descended from the easternmost core, Eastern societies. Because what happens with these cores where agriculture begins? Population grows, farmers begin to spread out into the territory around them, taking their new farming techniques to these territories. And these two maps here, these show you the western end on the left, the eastern end on the right, ends of the lucky latitudes in the old world. The numbers on the maps, if you can make them out, are dates BC. And it's showing you the spread out of farming from the original core areas, down here around 9,000 in the west, over here around 6,000 in the east. And on both these maps, I mean, you see the same basic pattern. The population grows, complex societies spread out and out, larger and larger areas come to be incorporated under these headings of west and east. Now, what I realized early on in my work I needed to do to make sense of this long-term pattern was to look at the areas within the West and the East that had the highest levels of social development at different points in time and compare those and see what this larger pattern of the history of social development was. Now, that all sounds pretty straightforward. Like most things in life, it turned out not to be quite that straightforward. Having said that, I then had this problem. Well, how do I actually do that? And for a while, I was stuck. The problem I got was I got this concept, social development, which is a big, I mean, I showed you the definition a second ago, a big, baggy, loose concept. What can you actually do to measure something that big and shapeless? Well, I did what academics always do when in trouble, which is steal somebody else's idea. And I was very fortunate. The United Nations, fine group of people, had solved my problem for me several years earlier. They had decided, in the late 80s, they decided it would be really useful to have a numerical index of human development, by which they basically meant how well our governments doing at creating conditions that allow their citizens to realize their innate human potential. So they said it'd be great if we had an index measuring this. that we can recalculate each year that'll then give donor organizations some simple guidelines when they're thinking about where in the world to make their investments and put their energy. So they hired a bunch of economists, very smart people, in late 1980s and said, we want you to come up with this single number index of human development that we'll publish each year. The economists went away and scratched their heads for a while, saying, well, how do you do that? Human development, again, big baggy concept. They came up with a really good idea. They said, what we need is measurable traits which relate to human development. And what we also need, we need to find the minimum number of these traits, which more or less covers what the UN means by human development. You know, we could have like an infinite number of traits you have to measure, but that would be useless because it would take you an infinite length of time, of course, to calculate your numbers. Pointless. We need the smallest possible number of traits that more or less covers the idea. So they said three traits will more or less cover this idea. And so what the UN guys look at is life expectancy at birth, real wages over people's lifetimes, and levels of education. They said they got these three traits. They came up with a very complicated scheme for weighting the different traits. They bundled them together into a single number for each country, and each year they publish a new report on human development. Every single year, Norway comes top in this report. It's extremely dull. They published a new one just a few weeks ago. In fact, Norway, again, was number one. Each year we seem to do slightly worse in the US, which is kind of depressing. Anyway, so that's what the UN guys did. And it occurred to me, well, you know, obviously this is what I need to do as well. My index, I'm measuring social development, not human development. It's a little bit different, so I'm going to need different traits. But that basic idea is what I should do. So I thought about it a little bit, and it seemed to me four traits rather than three would cover what I wanted to look at for social development, this sense of society's ability to get things done in the world. The four traits I came up with were energy capture per person, so how much energy we harvest from the world around us. Organization, you needed some kind of proxy to establish a level of organization societies have reached. Information technology with the next one. You know, what kind of tools the society has got for storing information, disseminating it, passing it on to future generations. And then last but sadly not least, war-making capacity. Because this, of course, was very much part of the definition of social development I read out to you a minute ago, ability to fight with these other communities. So, excuse me. So this is what I set out to do, to measure these four traits across 16,000 years since the late period of the Ice Age. It turned out, not surprisingly, that this was quite difficult. Each of these traits has got all kinds of problems, all kinds of difficulties you get into. But I think all four are roughly measurable across this period that I'm interested in doing within tolerable limits of error. Now, the way it works, I measured these traits looking back to 14,000 BC, which is the last period of the last ice age. And then my index stopped in the year AD 2000, which is a nice round number, fairly recent, but also gives us a couple of years since the thing finished to see how it's sort of playing out since then. For each trait, my four traits here, what I did was said that for the year 2000 AD, the last point in the index, The maximum score that's possible to get on each of these four traits it would be 250 points. So that my index as a whole, bundle the four together, 1,000 points was the highest score anybody could get in the year 2000 AD. And we can draw graphs of these Eastern and Western social developments, compare them, and all our problems will be solved. Great. Now, obviously, the sort of test of all this is how well it actually performs, how good are the data you're putting into this and making it all work. And when I started working on this, I had a very sobering experience. I was invited to give a talk at a well-known university in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so I thought, I'll go and talk about my index. That'll be fun. They'll all like that. And when you're a professor, you develop a very thick skin because basically you get paid to go into these rooms full of bright, highly intelligent, super motivated 19-year-olds and put them to sleep. This is basically what you do for a living. And so I got fairly thick skin about this, but I had never seen anything quite like what happened to this room full of distinguished academics when I went and talked about my index. It was like something out of the First World War. They were all slumped across this table unconscious about 10 minutes in. So I learned an important lesson. Don't do that. That is what I learned. So I am not going to take you on a death march through my index. I'm just going to pull out one of the four traits and give you a quick look at that so you've got a sense of the kind of thing I was doing. And in several ways, the most important to the four traits is the first one on the list, the energy capture. So I'm just going to give you a quick look into what it was I did calculating energy capture. So, okay, the United Nations tells us that energy capture in the year 2080 was higher than the world had ever seen before. That will not surprise you, I'm sure. The United States had the highest level of any part of the planet. Again, I'm sure that will not surprise you. The level was 228,000 kilocalories of energy per person per day on average. So the way I did this, I said, okay, that's the highest level ever attained. That's what scores 250 points on the index for that trait, the maximum score available in 2000. Therefore, for each, if there's 228,000 kilocalories, gets 250 points, 912 kilocalories per person per day gets you 1 point on the index. It's that simple. Just divide the one number into the other. 228,000 kilocalories is an enormous amount of energy, I should point out to you. Very little of that is in the form of food that we directly take into our bodies. The average American in 2000 consumed 3,460 kilocalories as food. Everybody varies in how much how much energy you need as food, depending on how big you are, how active you are. A typical adult that needs about 2,000 kilocalories a day. So, of course, we are consuming a lot more than we need, which is why some of us struggle a little bit with the old belly line. We're in fact consuming a lot more than 3,460 kilocalories because a lot of our food is what you might call expensive food. Like meat is the obvious thing. Food that you've had to use a lot of calories to produce one calorie of meat. And the standard conversion ratio energetics people use is it takes 10 calories of grain to produce one calorie of cow for you to eat. If you lived off lion, you would run the conversion again. It takes 10 kilocalories of cow to feed one kilocalorie of predator animal. So if you lived exclusively off lion meat, you would burn through, 346,000 kilocalories a day. But of course you don't. But a lot of people eat a lot of expensive calories. Probably the average American is really burning through something close to 30,000 kilocalories of food energy per day. The other 200,000 calories we get through every day is stuff like this. Our vast consumption of non-food energy that we use for things like driving to San Francisco and running our computers to pay PowerPoint shows so you can all hear some idiots talking about energy capture, flying around the world to talk about it more. This is what burns up this mind-boggling amount of energy that we guzzle through every day. So anyway, 228,000 for the average American in the year 2000, that gets you 250 points. So 912 kilocalories per person per day gets you 1 point. In Japan in the year 2000, the highest level of energy capture in the East, people were getting through about 104,000 kilocalories a day. So what's that? About 113.89 points is what the East scored in the year 2000. And this graph just shows you what we're talking about here. Along the bottom is points scored 0 up to 250 for social development in this energy capture category. On the vertical axis at the top, we've got two lines. Dividing the energy capture by 912 kilocalories per day to get the points. If we go back to the year 1900, highest energy capture in the West was in Britain, around 92,000 kilocalories per day. So that gets you almost exactly 100 points, the year 1900. Highest energy capture in the East was in Japan again, which was, let me just get the number right, about 49,000 kilocalories, 53.4 points in the year 1900. And basically what I did, just go back century by century, calculating these levels of energy capture, doing the sums, coming up with the numbers. And of course, as I go back, the kinds of evidence available constantly change, the difficulties involved change, but I keep doing it. In some ways, the difficulties increase the further you go back, but then there's this interesting thing. You go back far enough, the difficulties actually all melt away. If you go back to the very end of the Ice Age, actually that was a little Ice Age joke, the melt away thing. That's about as funny as it gets in archaeology, I should tell you. So you go back far enough, you get back to the simplest hunter-gatherers. We know a lot about hunter-gatherer society in the 20th century. On average, hunter-gatherers capture about 4,500 kilocalories a day. About half of that goes into food, half of it goes into all of their other needs. Ice Age hunter-gatherers probably captured a little bit higher, but not much higher. They were scoring almost certainly around about 4.25 points. Is fill in the gaps between them. So, That is what I set out to do. The trick is filling in the gaps. That is what the graph looked like, the final one that I came up with. Now, to decide how well I actually do it, obviously what you need is to go out there and buy my book and read it from cover to cover, and then you will be utterly convinced. I am not going to take you on a march of the whole book tonight, though. That would keep us here forever. Instead, what I'm going to do is quickly zip forward and talk about the results that I came up with, which I don't know, maybe you'll find it interesting. So what do we get then? Well, we calculate these four traits, bundle them together. What do we get? We get this rather disappointing... Oh, we get my book again. Great. This rather disappointing-looking graph. Not entirely obvious what we're getting here. Across the bottom... On the vertical axis, we've got score on the social development point, index from 0 to 1,000. The red line represents the eastern score, rather. The blue line represents the western score. Having said all that, rather hard to see very much actually going on in this graph here. Two things, though, I think do sort of jump out of the graph. The first is how similar the blue and the red lines are, which is a bit of a problem if you believe in this long-term Western lock-in of higher development scores. That's a little bit of a problem. The other thing I think we see here is how the lines sort of hug the bottom of the graph almost the whole way to 2000. Then about 200 years ago, take a 90-degree turn and shoot straight up. Now, the problem with this graph is that the second of these observations, that the lines shoot up so high, largely explains the first, that the lines look so similar. In order to fit the high scores for the year 2000 on the graph, you've got to squish everything else down so you can see it. If we take exactly the same data and display them in a different way, we see some interestingly different patterns. So this graph, exactly the same data, but now I'm displaying them on what statisticians will call a log linear scale, meaning the bottom line, again, just the same as the last graph, the bottom axis goes from 14,000 BC to AD 2000. The top one, the vertical axis, though, as you'll see, each increment you go up the graph, this sort of graph, you may well have seen graphs like this before if you've ever wondered how your credit card debt got to be so appalling. This is a great way to plot things that grow exponentially through sort of interest rates over time. And it allows you to see the details of what's going on early on. It's a little bit harder to read than a regular graph, but not that much harder. You very quickly get used to it. Now, what we see on this graph is that things are actually not quite the way they looked on the other graph. The lines are not the same through most of history. The blue western line has been higher than the red eastern line for 90% of the time since the end of the last ice age, which is an interesting pattern. But it hasn't been ahead all the time. There's a period from here to here, which doesn't look very much on this graph, but it actually represents 1,200 years, so about five times as long as the United States has been in existence, when eastern social development is a lot higher than western social development. So that's something that's got to be explained too. Second thing, on the last graph, it looks like the lines are very flat, then shoot up vertically. What we see on the log linear graph is that social development has been climbing for almost all the time since the end of the Ice Age, just very slowly through most of history. We also, though, the last point I want to draw attention to here, we see it hasn't always been climbing. There are periods when it stagnates, even periods when it collapses. Now, that's basically what needs to be explained. In the book that I published a couple of years ago, Why the West Rules for Now, I suggested that the answer is basically geography. The geography is the big driver in this story, but geography in a slightly complicated way. It's like geography is a two-way street. On the one hand, geography determines the rate at which social development increases in different parts of the world. But on the other hand, social development determines what the geography means. And the kind of things that are a big geographical advantage at one point in history may not be so later, which is why the history gets so complicated and messy. But what I want to do here for the remaining bit of my time is stick with this index, rather than sort of going into the explanations behind it, talk just a little bit more about the index that I talk about in my book. Now, producing this index, I had a great time doing it. It's full, if you like this kind of thing, it's full of these fascinating technical problems. Because basically, you're doing what I've been doing since I started out in this field. This is me, this handsome brute you see here, back in the late 1980s, excavating on a site in Greece. You're moving from broken stuff left over from the past to try to produce a single graphical representation of the whole shape of history. So all kinds of technical difficulties involved, which I must say, I had a blast doing this. Now, if we look at my graph, if you ask me, is this right? Does this show you the true and correct shape of history? I will tell you immediately, no. This graph is completely wrong. By definition, when you start trying to do something like this, you commit to being wrong. Because that's what you're going to be. It's impossible to be right in the sense of every single number in this graph is absolutely right, and we can prove it so. Just cannot be done. So the question, is it right? That's actually, I think, not the question we should be asking. What we should be asking is, how wrong is it? Is it so wrong that it distorts everything and it's useless? Or is it just sort of wrong enough, like everything else we do in life? Is it wrong within limits of error, margins of error that we can tolerate? And I, you will be shocked to hear, think the answer is, yeah, sure, it's wrong enough. We can muddle through, we can get by with this. Now, what I mean by that, one way to check the wrongness is to work through all the material I talk about in my book, looking at all the details and getting there. The other way is to say, well, let's establish the parameters of how wrong we can afford to be here. What if I were systematically 10% off with all my numbers? How important would that be? Say, if I had got all of the Western scores 10% too low and all of the Eastern scores 10% too high, if we corrected for that, how much difference would that make? So this graph shows you same data, but I've increased all the Western scores by 10%, lowered all the Eastern scores by 10%. We end up with basically the same pattern. The West score is now ahead even more of the time, 95% of the time since the end of the Ice Age. But they've got the same basic pattern we're still forced to explain. What if I got the error the other way around? So now we raise the Eastern scores 10%, drop the Western ones 10%. This is what the pattern would look like now. And again, you can see, I mean, obviously it's different, but we're still dealing with a pattern where Western social development has been higher than Eastern for most of the time since the end of the last Ice Age, but not all the time. So we're still dealing with basically the same pattern. What would we have to do? This is an obvious question. What would we have to do to invalidate what I'm saying, make my patterns just complete nonsense? You could do that by shifting the scores by 20%. So this graph, this shows you now I've raised all the Western scores by 20%, lowered all the Eastern ones by 20%. This has changed things significantly, because now the Western score is ahead of the Eastern 100% of the time since the end of the Ice Age, which if that were correct, then something would have to have happened during the Ice Age which made all the difference between West and East, and that never changed. However, we can be certain that this graph is ridiculous. This graph bears no relationship to reality. The reason I say that, when you look at different points on this graph, if we look at the Western score here, the age of Julius Caesar, the Western score there is actually as high as Japan's score in 1900, at the point Japan has gone through the Industrial Revolution. That is ridiculous. That can't be right. The graph cannot be 20% off in that direction. If we go the other direction, raising the Eastern score by 20%, lowering the Western one, now, again, we have a totally different pattern. Now the Eastern score is ahead almost all the time since the end of the Ice Age. But once again, these numbers don't make any sense. This would mean that in 1840, when the British shot their way into China during the Opium War, Eastern social development was still higher than Western social development at that point, which is clearly nonsense. So we can be pretty confident that the numbers I come up with are not 20% off. And if they're less than 20% off, then the basic pattern still holds good. So I'm pretty comfortable with being wrong. I think I'm wrong within manageable ranges. Okay, to wrap up then. Most interesting implication of this work to me, it goes back to the Winston Churchill thing about the farther you look back, the farther forward you're likely to see. I asked myself as I was doing this, what would happen if we use this index to sort of project these lines forward and ask ourselves, where might the big patterns of history be taking us in the future? So there's a lot of different ways you can do that. I'm going to show you now a graph resting on very conservative assumptions, saying what will happen if Eastern and Western social development continue rising for the next 100 years at the same pace they did for the last 100 years. If that were to come to pass, this is what we would get. Blue, our western line again, red, eastern line. And what you see,
here's us, blue line clearly ahead. Here, just after year 2100, the lines cross.
The eastern line catches up with the western line. In the year, you should probably make a note of this. This is a good prediction. In the year 2103, the east will catch up with the west. Now, this is, as I'm sure you realize, this is a perfect prediction. It's always told if you make predictions, they must be very precise. So if we get to 2104 and it didn't happen, you'll know I was a fool. Second reason it's a perfect prediction is if we get to 2104, I will be long dead and I won't care whether you think I'm a fool or not. So perfect prediction. Now, so that's a sort of interesting observation in its own right, I think. But the more interesting thing is not
where the lines cross down here, 2103, but where they cross over here on the vertical axis.
That is at around 5,000 points on my social development index. To get from the cave paintings at Altamira, from the end of the Ice Age, to the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, that costs you about 900 points in social development. The implication of these very conservative estimates is the next century will see an increase of 4,000 points. So more than four times as much change as we've seen in the whole of world history since the end of the Ice Age. Now that's an extraordinary projection to make, a science fiction kind of projection. What it means, many futurists argue endlessly about exactly what this sort of thing will mean, but it means if anything vaguely like this comes to pass, the world 100 years from now will be utterly unrecognizable to us in this room. It simply will seem like magic. Question though, will the world get to 5,000 points? Is this what will happen? The other thing I think we can learn from the index is when we look back across it, you see, it's mostly risen, but not always. There's been periods when it's collapsed spectacularly into what historians often like to call dark ages. Many of these have happened in the past. When they do happen, interesting thing, we tend to see the same five big forces behind the great collapses in earlier history. What I cheerfully started calling the five horsemen of the apocalypse. Every time there's a major social collapse, mass migration on a huge scale is always involved in it, bigger than the societies can control. Always there, often driven by the mass migration, is huge new epidemic diseases, often created when people who have previously not been in contact merge their disease pools, all kinds of new unknown diseases mutate, people don't have antibodies to meet them, mass epidemic diseases. Third thing, on the back of the epidemic diseases, the collapse of governments, the state failure. This always is in there. Fourth thing, as the states collapse, trade routes collapse with them, no one is policing these things, massive famines. In the big collapses, it's not uncommon to see population fall by 50% in the course of a generation or two. Fifth thing that's always in there in a complicated kind of way, not straightforward at all, climate change, always mixed up in there somewhere. Now, you don't need me to tell you that these five forces crop up again and again in the news shows, in the weekly news magazines. They are things that a lot of people think are hovering over us in the 21st century. I think it's perfectly possible the 21st century will see a rerun of the kind of collapse we've seen before, the kind of thing that happens at the end of the Roman Empire, history rerunning itself, but with one big difference, that we have things the Romans did not have. Particularly, we have nuclear weapons. Romans would have loved nuclear weapons. They would have used them in a heartbeat. This is actually old nuclear technology. This is 60 years old, a long Tom cannon from the Korean War period. Cannons actually firing nuclear weapons. We have nuclear weapons. Now, the good news is that for every 20 warheads in the world in 1986, there is now only one. That's really good. We could no longer kill more than a billion people in one day. I mean, that is great news. It would take us weeks to build enough warheads to kill billions of people, which is the sort of the downside of it. It seems to me that there's a perfectly real possibility the 21st century seeing a rerun of the kind of collapse we've seen again and again in the past, but on a scale that dwarfs anything that's ever happened before. So it seems to me, pattern of the past suggests that one way or another, the next 100 years is going to be the greatest discontinuity humanity has ever seen. One way or another, 21st century will be a period of either transformation or disaster. Okay, so the claims then that I've made to wrap up. I've claimed that we can measure social development across thousands of years of history. I've conceded that the numbers are always going to be contested, but that's okay because the errors are manageable and you can calculate what the errors are. So this, I think, is okay. The calculations I've made suggest, as many people suggest, that the balance in global power is shifting, that the East is catching up with the West. They suggest that the United States is likely to remain kind of at the center of the world for the next generation, very possibly for the next two generations, probably not for the next three generations. Perhaps most important, though, they also suggest history, in a sense, is speeding up. Change is going so much faster than it ever has before. The 21st century is a kind of race between a shift in global power, transformation of humanity, and catastrophe. Now, the bad news is that these great shifts, when they've happened before in history, they've always, without exception, been accompanied by mass violence. That's the bad news. And I'm writing a new book about this at the moment, because I think this is kind of the interesting thing here. The good news, though, it's a cheerful book. The good news is that there's a lot to be worried about, but I think there's also good reason to be optimistic. Again, when you look back over the long run of the history of violence, humans have learned to manage violence remarkably well across the last 20,000 years. If you had been born in a Stone Age society, your chance of dying violently would be in the 10 to 20% range, so 1 in 10 or 1 in 5. 10 to 20% chance someone will kill you with violence. If you lived through the 20th century, and looking around looks to me like a lot of you did, if you lived through the 20th century, two world wars, nuclear weapons get used, the Holocaust, your chance of dying violently, 1 to 2%, fallen by an order of magnitude. This is an extraordinary achievement that we often don't realize that we have done. I think that there is a very, very good reason for believing that we are learning to manage violence and that going forward, we can be confident that the future is going to look something like this graph. The future is going to be richer, safer, and more amazing than ever. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
I want to remind our audience here and also our online and radio audience that we've been listening to Ian Morris, Measuring 15,000 Years of Human Development, and we have time for some questions. And because we are recording, we ask that you please use the microphone when you ask your questions, and I'll get it. I think we're on the air.
The graph shows things continually going up like this, but that means that they're using more energy. Well, doesn't that look like that there must be an infinite supply of energy somewhere for it to keep going on up?
Yeah, great question. When I was talking about how I'd done the calculations, I used energy as my example because that, in a lot of ways, that's the most important thing here. You could say that the other three traits I looked at are the organization, information technology, war-making capacity. These are all ways of using energy. It all depends on how much energy you're capturing. So, yeah, the world at 5,000-point scenario, that depends on the capture of vastly more energy than we are currently using, which in some ways isn't a alarming prospect, obviously. It seems to me that there is, from a human perspective, there is almost infinite energy available, that we just don't know how to capture and use it effectively. I'm sure I'll get the numbers wrong, I always do, but we use a tiny, tiny fraction of 1% of the solar energy that falls on Earth every day would more than take care of all of our energy needs for the entire planet, if we knew how to capture it and use it in constructive ways. And I would say our situation is not so different from where people were, like around about 1700, when they were living basically in a farming age over much of the world, and they had these severe energy constraints. They couldn't feed the populations. All kinds of problems were developing. The way the problems got solved was by people sort of innovating and breaking through this energy ceiling over them to a whole new form of energy, which is fossil fuels, which for a long time was spectacularly successful. This drove this great explosion of wealth that we now live in. What we've now learned, of course, is that like everything else in the world, it's got its dark side. You keep burning carbon. The goes somewhere. It goes into the atmosphere, goes into the oceans. And of course, at a certain point, the air and the sea are big. But at a certain point, we begin to have rather alarming, unintended side effects. Well, the good news, again, some of you, I'm sure, will have heard this. The trends in temperature change actually weirdly sort of flattened off in the last 10 years, even though the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and the sea keeps increasing. And what we don't know is we don't understand how the feedback processes work. And it may be that it now will explode in the next 10 years. We just don't know. But this sort of scenario, the onward and upward scenario, it seems to me this depends on us solving this energy problem that we've currently got. Some people, until quite recently, were saying, well, yeah, we're going to run out of fossil fuels at some point. If we had all kinds of technological advances in the last 2 or 3 years, we are not going to run out of fossil fuels in any of our lifetimes. Spectacular new supplies now available. But do we really want to be pumping all that into the atmosphere? It seems to me that unless we are able to move on to non-polluting, much less dirty sources of energy, the more we're able to move toward the non-polluting sources of energy, the more likely this outcome is. The more we fail to shift our energy sources, the more likely we are to have the catastrophe scenario, I would say.
Another question?
Hi. If geography and climate played a big role in social development in the past, the lucky latitudes, what role will geography and climate play in future social development?
Yeah, that's another really interesting question. One of the main argument in the book Why the West Rules that I wrote, published a couple of years ago, the core argument in that was about this back and forth between geography and social development. That geography drives the social development in that, you know, if you lived at the end of the Ice Age, you lived in one of these places where there were plants and animals like wheat and barley and sheep and goats and so on that you could domesticate, your social development was going to rocket upward compared to that of people, say, you live in the middle of Siberia or something where these things just don't exist. You cannot have an indigenous agricultural revolution there. But as your societies get bigger and more complex and development rises, that starts to change what the geography means. And so you get to a certain level of complexity, and people were able to start doing things like tapping into the great rivers like the Nile and the Tigris and the Euphrates, changing the meaning of geography. Suddenly Egypt and what's now Iraq become these places where development can rise higher than anywhere else in the world, whereas earlier they were not particularly exciting places. Where I grew up in England, you know, this horrible little island stuck out in the cold Atlantic Ocean. Basically, it's a lump of coal with some grass on top. And through most of history, terrible place, geographically very disadvantaged. But if you start having an industrial revolution, oh boy, is that a good place to live. And you know, the meaning of the geography keeps changing. Now, implication of a graph like this one with the soaring development is, I think, of course, the geography is going to change its meaning faster than ever before, which I think is the big driver of the history of the last 200 years has been this speeding up in the changing of the meanings of geography. And I would say, I mean, in some ways, the obvious conclusion to reach from looking at the long run in history is that geography is gradually kind of losing its meaning. And, I mean, it hasn't lost its meanings altogether. Obviously, if you're born in San Francisco, your life is going to be very different than if you're born in Burkina Faso. I mean, geography matters a lot in the world we live in still. But on the other hand, last week I flew, for reasons I won't go into, I flew out to Lubbock, Texas. And it was going out there was a kind of grim trip, I got to say, in all sorts of ways. But I got off the plane feeling very sorry for myself. I've been on this plane like 6 hours going to these different places. But, of course, if I'd gone to Lubbock 100 years ago, the thought of flying there in 6 hours, that would seem like magic. I mean, the space has changed its meaning so much. And of course, the internet has a lot to do with why this is accelerating in our own day. And again, if something like this comes to pass, the 5,000-point scenario, my guess would be that geography is going to lose a lot of the meanings it currently has. I mean, I'd be surprised if it ever loses its meaning altogether, but a lot of the spatial problems that we deal with, I think, are going to go away in the next 100 years. Like, say, I mean, stuff like you're going to meetings. I mean, there are people, I even know some of these people, who go to meetings by sending avatars now. They don't go themselves, because that is so 20th century. So you're avatar goes, because the technology, I mean, many of you may have tried this. I mean, it's very clumsy. It just feels a bit weird, frankly. But I will bet you 20 years from now it won't feel weird anymore. So my guess is that the geography's meaning is going to change so much in the next 100 years that it might sort of cease to mean very much at all.
Another question over here.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the book Why Nations Fail and the thesis of that book versus your thesis, which is a geography thesis, and that is more of an institutional thesis.
Right. Yeah, I don't know how many of you have seen this book by Daron Acemoglu and Jim Robinson. Daron is an economist at MIT, and Jim Robinson is a political scientist at Harvard University. And they wrote this great book that came out last year called Why Nations Fail. And it was, as the title suggests, it was looking at why nations fail and what nations need to do not to fail. And one of the linchpins in their argument, as you were saying, it's a sort of anti-geographical argument. They say, I think they start the story with Nogales. They say, look at Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales in Mexico. They're separated by just this little fence, a few miles apart, completely different places to live. Or look at North Korea and South Korea. They're saying, geography has really very little to do with anything. It's all about institutions, the institutions people create. This is what makes all the difference between nations succeeding and failing. And I guess I agree with what they're saying. I actually wrote a very positive blurb for the book and reviewed it. And I agree with a lot of what they're saying, except I think they gave the book the wrong title. Their book ought to be called How Nations Fail. And in their book, it's not about the real causes of what's happening. It's about the process through which nations succeed or fail in relatively recent history, just across the last 300 years or so. And when they're talking about, say, the core case they take off from is England in the 17th century, has all these reforms in 1688, the Glorious Revolution, creates a legal, political framework that's much more friendly for capitalists to start investing their wealth, driving the Industrial Revolution ultimately in Britain. And they quite rightly say that these new rules and regulations that come in, this was decisive for England. If the English had not done this, they would not have moved so rapidly across the 18th century and had an Industrial Revolution at the end. And I think they're quite right about that. But I say, all three of us are good buddies, so we've had this argument many, many times. What I say to them is that, yes, okay, but if England had not done what it did in the late 17th century, you're right, it wouldn't have had an Industrial Revolution beginning at the end of the 18th century. But what do you think would have happened? If England had not done what it did, I think there's a very sound case to be made that France was not far behind. If England had not had an Industrial Revolution in the late 18th century, by 1850, almost certainly France would have done. If England, because it depends on how you want to change history to make England not do it, depending on how much you change it, there's a very good chance England would have had its Industrial Revolution by 1850 itself anyway. If England hadn't, there's a very good chance the United States would have done this, rather than sort of racing to catch up with England later. The bigger geographical patterns determined that in this little part of the world around the North Atlantic, these developments were going on. This was driven by stuff that goes back thousands of years. So I think their book is a great description of how the process happened, but it misses out the deeper explanatory forces that you really need to look at to get to the why part of it. But if they were here, they would tell you something completely different.
In your research, did you happen to find any commonalities in the conditions that prevailed when the downturns leveled off? And when something, what triggered the upticks?
Yeah, great question. And what sets off the recoveries? And yes, I was very interested in this, but I got to say, I found just an awful lot of variation in this. And I think at an abstract level, you can kind of, you can sort of get away with just saying, well, these five horsemen of the apocalypse, they run their course, the plagues sort of level out, human bodies adapt to the new and disease environment, population levels starts growing again, the institutional failures, people work it all out, and things sort of start recovering again. And you know, at an abstract level, that is true, I think. What's much harder to explain is why it takes different lengths of time at different points. Like, say, at the end of the ancient world, one of the big collapses, the Han Dynasty China starts kind of falling to bits in the first century AD. The Roman Empire at the other end of Eurasia starts running into very similar problems at the end of the second century AD. They both have just a horrible time in the third century. By the 5th century, Han China, well, it's not Han China anymore, Han Empire is gone. China is beginning to recover. In the 6th century, it gets reunited into a single great empire. That doesn't happen at the western end of Eurasia. And there, it takes, gosh, how long is it? It takes over 1,000 years for the western end, the Europe, Near East, North Africa, to get back to the level of development they were at, say, in the 2nd century AD. And there, It is much harder to say why it takes so long in that case. Or actually another one, a much less well understood one, would be the ancient Bronze Age Indus Valley civilization in Pakistan, which is one of the earliest great city empire civilizations in the world. Around 1900 BC, I guess the computer is telling me to shut up, but around 1900 BC, these cities all burn to the ground, and then 1,000 years goes by before people start building cities again. And we really don't know why, partly for the very good reason that archaeologists are a little hesitant to go and dig in Pakistan for obvious reasons there. But, I mean, eventually evidence will accumulate. We will figure this out. But, yeah, I'm afraid I just don't have a very good answer on that.
Again, we're listening to Ian Morris on the measurement of civilization. And I think we have time for one more very short question. And afterwards, Ian will be signing a few of his books on the measurement of civilization.
On your criteria, did you weigh them any higher? You know, like communication had more of an effect. I mean, by the graph, at 1900 is when everything starts to explode. So that's the Industrial Revolution, which is everything.
Mm-hmm.
Power, energy, communication. So in your criteria, did they hold higher weight? Did one of those hold a higher weight?
Yeah, that sort of plunges it into the technicalities of how you do these calculations. And I mean, one of the things I would say about what I'm doing, obviously very numerical kind of thing, but the numbers don't make what you're doing any more objective than if you were doing this in more qualitative, descriptive terms. They just make it more explicit. And so what I did with my 4 traits, unlike the United Nations economists, I didn't weight the traits at all. Because I could not figure out any justification for one particular weighting over another. And I said, we're going to use the year 2000, the maximum possible scores in 2000, as kind of the baseline from which we do the calculating. I could have picked a totally different point in history to do this from. Each of these different decisions would produce somewhat different scores and lines. Different ways of displaying the data would create very different impressions from this evidence. And there's no way for anybody to say that one way of doing this is better than another way of doing it, which is because why we have the old line about there being lies, damn lies, and statistics. You make your choices and you do what you think is the right way to do it. But although I don't think that my numerical approach is more objective than a more literary type approach, I do think it's more explicit. And this, I would say, is the one thing I would like to claim for my index. And you may think I am completely full of it and everything I've said is complete nonsense. But because I've said the score for 1700 is 43, or whatever the score is, I've said the score is 43, I have to have reasons. I have to be able to explain why I came up with those numbers. And so you can look at what I've done and challenge me on the evidence, challenge me on the ways I've done the calculations, even challenge on the principle of, is it really sensible to try to do a numerical approach at all? And now all of these things, I have to be explicit and explain exactly what it is I'm doing, which then makes it easier for other people to pick up what I've done and counterattack it and hopefully come up with something better, which is why I was saying at the beginning, I think what an approach like this can do is at least get everybody arguing productively. I mean, even if I long ago gave up thinking I was going to persuade anybody, I would now like to think that at least when they are telling me I'm wrong, it's leading us toward a better place. So thanks for the questions.
Thank you, Ian Morris.
Thank you.
This concludes our meeting.